Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. With evidence to prove that the Chinese pioneered inventions from movable type to smallpox vaccinations to gunpowder centuries before the rest of the world, why did the rise of modern science take place not in China but in the West? That question is known today as the Needham question, named for the extraordinary and eccentric English nudist, socialist, and biochemist who first articulated it, then devoted his life to seeking the answer. Simon Winchester tells Joseph Needham's fascinating story in a new book called The Man Who Loved China, the fantastic story of the eccentric scientist who unlocked the mysteries of the Middle Kingdom. Simon, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks very much, Chris.
It'll become clear as we get into this conversation why you got interested in Needham, but can you talk about when you first came across this story?
Yes, I think it was 94 or 95, I was writing a book about the Yangtze, and there came a moment when I needed to know what sailing junks looked like that went upstream through the Three Gorges, that part of the Yangtze now, of course, stilled by this enormous dam, but in early times was a ferocious stream about 300 miles long. How did a sailing junk get up against the current? And someone said to me, well, find out what they looked like back in the 16th and 17th centuries, there are two books to consult, G.R.G. Worcester, The Junks and Sampans of the Yangtze, or Volume 4, Part 3 of Science and Civilization in China by Joseph Needham. And I'd never heard of either of these books, but the following morning I went to a bookseller I knew in Salisbury, Connecticut, a chap called Mike McCabe, who's a big hero of mine because he knows everything about books, and I said, have you ever heard of a book called Junks and Sampans of the Yangtze? And he said, oh, you mean G.R.G. Worcester? We normally have copies of that. And I said, so typical, Mike. Okay, I'll have that. I'll go for broke now. Have you ever heard of a book called Science and Civilization in China? And he looked at me as if I was some sort of insect. He said, what do you mean? I mean, Joseph Needham is what you're talking about. And I said, yeah. He said, you've never heard of him? And I said, I haven't. And he said, he is the most extraordinary, most famous Englishman ever to have lived in China, and he created almost single-handedly a book that's now 24 volumes long devoted to Chinese science. And we occasionally get full sets, although they're very expensive, but I know we've got one volume downstairs, and he went downstairs, and lo and behold, it was Volume 4, Part 3, the one I wanted. And so I sat in the car looking at this amazing book, nearly 1,000 pages long, about everything that was involved with China's relationship with water, so the design of the boats that I was interested in, but also lighthouses and lock gates and canals and rudders and compasses. And I thought, my gosh, this is only one of 24 volumes, and that there are similar books on botany and medicine and alchemy and astronomy. Who on earth was it that put it all together? And that's, I think, when I began being fascinated by Joseph Needham.
So Needham was raised in a physically comfortable environment, but by parents who made each other miserable. They disagreed so often that they would address him by different names. Is that right? Because they couldn't agree what his first name should be.
Indeed. I mean, they were most extraordinary people. Father was a very sort of ascetic, severe anesthesiologist in Victorian London. Mother was a complete mad woman, as far as one can see. She was Irish-French, and her one claim to fame is that she composed what in Britain is called the drunkard's lullaby. It's a song that whenever people are arrested coming out of pubs, they're normally singing something called Nellie Dean, and Mrs. Needham composed that. The two of them did not get on at all well, and you're absolutely right. The trouble began at the font because they called him Noel Joseph Terence Montgomery Needham, with mother calling him Terence and father calling him Noel, and he decided he called himself Joseph as a compromise.
So, as a child, how did he find refuge from all that angst around him?
By learning and by reading. I mean, his father, to be fair to him, was an extremely good parent. I mean, he tried in the way that Mrs. Needham clearly didn't or couldn't. And he therefore encouraged his young boy to either to go abroad, which he did a lot, and as a consequence learned very many languages very quickly. He could speak, as well as the conventional, French, German, and Spanish, which was just trivial to him. He also spoke Polish and Russian by the time he was 16, and Greek and Latin. So he was linguistically fairly well on. But he read a great deal, an enormous amount, and so he sequestered himself in the top floor room that he, in their very big house in southwest London, and just read and read and read.
He did, however, write horrendous poetry.
Oh, terrible. I can't begin to tell you. There were two things he couldn't do. One was he was very keen on dancing in later life, but he was very keen on it, but he was very bad at it. And so someone said, you better watch your toes if you dance with Joseph, which was a better poem than any poem he wrote.
It makes you like him, though, the fact that he was so good at so many things and he would still sort of forge ahead with all these things that he wasn't any good at.
Yeah, he was a sort of bumbling idiot in a way. I mean, he was like sort of an enormous Harry Potter, but wonderful. I love them. I mean, I really, I tend to love these characters that I write about, William Smith, James Murray, but I love Joseph Needham. He's such an enthusiastic man, but with an extraordinary achievement under his belt.
Well, it's funny, he even looks like Harry Potter. He's got this shock of black hair and the little dark horn-rimmed glasses.
Yeah, he's just missing a wizard's wand and a few owls.
So, Needham grew up to be very, very liberal, both politically and socially. Can you talk about how that manifested itself?
Yes, I mean, first, politically, he grew up such that when he was on his way to university, Cambridge, he began in 1918. That was just in the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution. And like a lot of young people at the time, he was swept up by the excitement of Bolshevism and became an extremely left-wing socialist. He never actually became a card-carrying member of the Communist Party, but he was a very keen socialist. He was also, oddly, a very energetic Christian, and one might argue, debate, and become fascinated by how he could match his keen Christianity with his keen belief in almost doctrinaire Marxism, certainly socially. He would argue that Christ was a socialist, of course. But he was also very liberal socially, insofar as when he eventually got married in the 1920s to a lady called Dorothy, also very left-wing, also very Christian, he said right at the altar that I intend to pursue other romantic interests while I'm married, and I hope that's all right with you. And she rather weakly said, well, okay, Joseph, yes. And I think she behaved herself fairly well, but he did not.
It is pretty extraordinary that his father, who was, you know, a doctor, a scientist in that regard, would take him to church, and their preacher was very big on trying to sort of convert people to the ideas of Darwinism within the framework of Christianity.
Very much so. I mean, and this is an important aspect of his life, that the Christianity that, I mean, he would not, for instance, countenance Mike Huckabee's view of the world. He was very much a believer in Darwinism, so, and he didn't think that Christianity, if sensibly applied, in any way conflicted with the views of evolution. He, of course, thought that, you know, that Genesis was, if literally taken to be true, was nonsense, but nonetheless believed in God and you know, right behavior and ethics and all that sort of thing. So he was very much a robust, muscular Christian scientist, but not a Christian scientist in the Mary Baker Eddy sense.
And what made him decide that nudism was such a wonderful lifestyle?
Well, it was all to do with left-wing behavior in the 20s. It wasn't, of course, called nudism in those days. It was called gymnosophy. And it was a way, really, of left-wing people showing that we're all equal once we take our kit off, and we're all as God made us once he remembered his Christianity. So he became a very keen nudist, and various women in his life, particularly Dorothy, were not quite so keen, and Dorothy wasn't terribly attractive. But, of course, nudists remind me that it's nothing to do with how beautiful you are, that all bodies are equally beautiful. And I might say, as I'm talking to you in Texas, that I had a letter recently, a telephone call actually, from a nudist literary society in Texas who took me to task for mentioning in a footnote of a previous book that Charles Richter of the Richter scale was eccentric because he was a nudist. And they wrote and said, there's nothing eccentric about being nude. And I said, all right, but as a matter of fact, I said, I'm just writing a book about a chap called Joseph Needham, and I devote two pages to the fact that he was a nudist. And she said, well, this is wonderful. Can you please come and address the nudist literary society? You may, however, leave your clothes on. Thank God for all concerned.
If nothing else down here, you need a lot of sunscreen.
Yes, quite.
Simon Winchester is my guest. His new book is called The Man Who Loved China, the fantastic story of the eccentric scientist who unlocked the mysteries of the Middle Kingdom. So Needham and Dorothy both, they're both biochemists. They're working at this university. In 1937, another scientist comes from Shanghai. Can you talk about her?
Yes, and that really changed everything. So Dorothy and Joseph were settled into a left-wing intellectual existence, Dorothy being an expert on the mechanics of muscles, the muscles in your arm and leg, and Joseph an expert on the development of the egg. He was an embryologist. And then suddenly, essentially out of a clear blue sky from Shanghai, as you mentioned, comes this young woman called Lu Guizhen. And Guizhen became, first of all, a student, a PhD student, under Dorothy's supervision, but Joseph, who was already fairly keenly pursuing his interest in other ladies, saw this pretty, lissom, small, intensely clever young woman and fell head over heels in love with her. And the love affair is essentially what led him to China, because Guizhen, in 1938, February, when he had had his first, how can we say it politely, when he consummated the affair, in the early morning hours, she taught him the first ever Chinese character. And he was so overwhelmed by the beauty of the calligraphy that she showed him, and he tried to practice it again and eventually got it right, that he said he wanted to devote the rest of his life to learning, to entering what he called the glittering crystalline world of the Chinese language. He learned the language, and by that, through that, fell in love with China.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful quote from him, because he talks about being freed from the boundaries of alphabetical speech.
It is something. I mean, good Lord, I'm not nearly as brainy as Needham, but I've tried. And once you get immersed in Chinese calligraphy, it is just a wonderfully, wonderfully, it's so beautiful, and it's so ancient as well. You're writing characters that have been essentially unchanged. You can read a document written 3,000 years ago, and it's essentially the same, whereas the same cannot be said for our rather limited alphabet.
So we're talking about a time when China is being occupied by the Japanese. The British government, meanwhile, sees a value to developing its strategic alliance with China. Can you talk about how Needham was assigned to go there and work for the British government?
Yes. I mean, it's not quite as brutal as that, I don't think. I mean, what had happened in 1937 is that the Japanese had occupied essentially the eastern third of China, and all the great universities in eastern China, those in Shanghai and Beijing and Tianjin and Nanjing and so forth, had fled lock, stock and barrel into the comparative safety of unoccupied western China. The equivalent would be if Harvard and Yale packed up all their students, put them on donkeys with all their books and boxes and laboratory equipment, and trekked thousands of miles, or more than 1,000 miles, to Dallas, where things would be safer. That was what was happening in the 1930s, and the British government saw this and said, we've got to help these poor people, these universities, and keep Chinese intellectual life, particularly scientific life, alive by transporting to these universities by air from Calcutta, the air bridge that then existed, to Western China, textbooks and scientific papers and laboratory equipment and all the stuff to keep a university's science department alive. They looked, they said, well, I wonder if there's a scientist in Britain who speaks Chinese. And they found Joseph Needham. And the rest is history, because he went there in 1943 and began his lifelong fascination with Chinese science and Chinese history.
After the break, we'll talk about what Joseph Needham discovered when he arrived. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. My guest this hour is Simon Winchester. His new book is called The Man Who Loved China, the fantastic story of the eccentric scientist who unlocked the mysteries of the Middle Kingdom.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
Yeah. You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Simon Winchester. His latest book is called The Man Who Loved China, the fantastic story of the eccentric scientist who unlocked the mysteries of the Middle Kingdom. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. How, at this time, beyond wanting to sort of help the Chinese in the universities, what was the view of most British people of China's abilities and of its history? Was there an appreciation for the things that China had done in its past?
Very little, and I think that view extended across the Atlantic to America as well. I mean, the classic remark was made by Emerson, the poet, when he derided China as this booby nation. This was a country which 1,000 years before had been highly regarded by the rest of the world. The great cities of China were known and were praised as being models of efficiency and beauty. But then something had happened, and the country had started to be gnawed away at by foreign powers. The British, after all, got Hong Kong after the Opium War in the 1840s, and then the French in Hainan, and the Germans in Shandong, and the Russians and the Japanese, plus the revolution had wiped away 2,000 years of imperial rule in 1911. The country was riven by warlordism, civil war, corruption. It was a mess. And people dismissed China as a place that basically gave us rhubarb and tea and porcelain, and that was about it. So Needham, when he went there in 1943, the only person that said to him, "You should look at China with a more sympathetic I was his mistress, Gui Zhen. And she said, "When you get there, keep an open mind, because I think you will discover that there's a great deal more depth to this, to my remarkable country, than people say there is in the West."
Speaking of keeping an open mind, we should point out here that Dorothy Needham knew about Gui Zhen and vice versa. And they both, I guess, according to the tenets of the marriage they had set out, Dorothy was at least accepting of the relationship.
Yes, I mean, I think the word is complacent, really, in the sort of socialist spirit of the times. I think from looking at her diaries, which are much more discreet and circumspect, she wasn't desperately happy by the arrangement, but she liked Gui Zhen, and the three of them would travel together. They would often go before, and indeed after the China episodes, they would go to France and Scotland together. So they were good chums, and I think Dorothy accepted it, but I think with some real regret as well that he wasn't at all faithful to her.
But when the Needhams were in China, Gui Zhen was actually working in California. Is that right?
Well, it's slightly complicated. When Joseph went off, then Gui Zhen was in Berkeley, and then got an allergy to acacia flowers, went to Birmingham, Alabama for a while, and then ended up at Columbia University in New York lecturing there. And Joseph, after he had settled himself in China, said, "You know, I miss you terribly. Can you come on over?" And she eventually did.
So he was traveling. He was performing his official function, but he was also traveling to really rural, remote parts of the country, just sort of interviewing people and investigating inventions that he had learned took place in China.
Exactly. I mean, this fascination began really, on day one. He arrived from Calcutta by plane over the Himalayas in Kunming on a crisp early spring day. Utterly beautiful. I mean, he was a great diarist, and he records that moment, how he sat in the sunshine smoking. He was a complete addicted chain smoker, although never a cigarette before noon, but there was always one lined up to be lit the moment the clock struck 12. The clock, incidentally, in Caius College that you may remember from that extraordinary film about the athletes in Britain. I can't even remember the name of it, but anyway, a famous film 20 or so years ago.
Chariots of Fire.
Chariots of Fire, exactly. That was his college, and that bell that rang when they ran round the quadrangle was the bell that signaled that he could start smoking.
Time for tobacco.
Time for tobacco, exactly. But now he's in China, and he is sitting there in the sunshine smoking, and he's looking at a man grafting an apple tree. And he thinks, as he watches this man, that he's, hang on a bit, he says he's working in a way different from the way that his father would work when grafting an apple tree in their garden in London. So he thought, the Chinese do things differently, let me take notes. And so he took notes, and he drew these lovely little drawings, and he said, "I must look up and see something about the antiquity of Chinese apple grafting, and indeed found out stuff that showed that the Chinese had a profound knowledge of horticulture, and of course the apple had originated in China long before the British or anybody else in Europe had started sensibly thinking about how to raise apples. And so that made him think, when he went about a week later to have a robe made, he looked at this extraordinary calculating machine, the abacus, and thought to himself, well, perhaps the Chinese have had mechanical calculating machines long before we have in the West. Perhaps their whole concept of number predates ours. And this began him on this path of, let's find out everything that the Chinese did first. And so he went all over the country, thousands and thousands of miles, and found this most extraordinary tally of Chinese inventions.
The story about having the robe made is a charming one, because just a couple days after he arrived, he decided he wanted to have this piece of clothing that sort of made him look like the locals.
Yes, and indeed the pictures, he loved dressing up in Chinese robes. He was a very sort of flamboyant man. I mean, we've talked about his nudism, which is, of course, covered by this robe, but he was also keen on strange forms of dancing. There's this English pagan dancing known as Morris dancing. I dare say there are a few eccentric chapters in America where they practice Morris dancing. But he would dance in his robe, I hasten to say. Otherwise, it would not be something one would think about. Also, he'd play the accordion while doing so, and he used to give demonstrations in these remote parts of China. So when you think of this tall, Harry Potter-like figure dancing wildly these English pagan dances while playing the accordion and chain-smoking, it's a pretty odd image.
And he was, certainly to his credit for the times, very tolerant. He had a very close friend who was gay and didn't have any issues with that.
None at all. I mean, his very, you're absolutely right, Rui Ali, rather unusual name. Rui Ali, the most famous New Zealander ever to have lived in China. He discovered him in a remote village called Shuangshupu. And the wonderful thing about Rui Ali, I mean, he was an extraordinary man and well deserving of a book himself. But he gave the world the phrase gung-ho. You know, people say you're very gung-ho about something. Well, that was the motto which Rui Ali came up with. It means ourselves together. And it was a cooperative movement that Rui Ali invented, making thousands and thousands of little factories all over China to produce goods that the factories that had been bombed by the Japanese could not make. So he's an extraordinary, I mean, really a personification of small is beautiful, and gung-ho is one of his legacies.
So Winchester, who always had sort of a taxonomic way of thinking, goes about taking notes on everything that he discovers and decides to put it all in a book. He published one very early on, and then the real volume that led to the 24 that you talked about came later. But can you talk about sort of what he was discovering, especially in the beginning parts?
Yes, well, the classic, I suppose, and we should say that one of his teachers at school, F.W. Sanderson, one of the mantras, he was a big man for mantras, and like his father, Joseph's father, would say, never go upstairs empty-handed, which I've certainly taken every time I go upstairs in my house now. I always make sure I take something with me. It's a very useful tip.
Put things away, that sort of thing.
Well, exactly. Never have three helpings of anything. You catch more flies with honey than with vinegar. I mean, anyway, one of the sayings was, think in oceans. In other words, only think big thoughts. And he did, right from when he was in his early 20s, he wrote a 3-volume book on embryology, which remains a classic to this day. This showed that Needham was a man of very considerable brain. So by the time he got to China and started thinking about the history of Chinese science, he was already thinking in big terms, that he could put this all down in a book which, although initially he thought it would be one volume, it turned eventually into what it is now, which is 24 volumes. But his initial thinking was based really on another mantra, which was Francis Bacon's famous remark that the three greatest inventions that dominated human history were gunpowder, the compass, and printing. And when Francis Bacon made that remark in the 17th century, he had no knowledge of where these three things came from. Needham proved without a doubt that printing, I mean, we always think printing is Gutenberg or Caxton in the 14th, 15th centuries. Not at all. In Dunhuang, in western Chinese Turkestan, there is a document called the Diamond Sutra, which to the Chinese angst is in London now in the British Library, but that was printed in 868 AD, 600 years before anyone in the West came up with the idea of movable block printing. Similarly with gunpowder, similarly with the compass, which we've always thought it was a Mediterranean invention, but it wasn't. The Chinese were using compasses, which interestingly pointed to the south, not the north, hundreds of years before that. So as Needham continued to amass this long, long list of Chinese firsts, he then began to think, I must put all this into a book.
And as he's doing this, this other question, this grand question occurs to him that he just can't quite put to rest.
He can't, and it's become eponymous. It is the Needham question. And basically, the Needham question says, if the Chinese invented so much so early, gunpowder, printing, the compass, the stirrup, I mean, hugely important invention, the stirrup, the chain, blast furnaces, air conditioning fans, toilet paper, of all things. The Chinese were using toilet paper in the 11th century, I think. If they'd invented all of this stuff so early, how come they were so backward when he went along to see them? How come they had been so backward essentially since the 17th century? Why was the tide of human invention essentially now running in the West? Why had Galileo and Newton and Kepler and eventually Einstein had all been Westerners? What had happened to stop Chinese scientific progress in its tracks? That's the Needham question.
Do you think, Simon, that he really wanted the answer to that question?
I think, quite honestly, the amassment of facts, of evidence, I think overtook his willingness to confront this question head on. And the question is still asked to this day. There have been some sort of half-hearted answers to it. It's difficult to prove a negative, to say, you know, why did the Chinese not? It's somewhat easier to say, why did the West succeed so well in coming up with scientific advances after the Renaissance? But in a sense, perhaps there's no need to ask the question, because in the vast sweep of Chinese history, 5,000 years, I mean, it's an ancient civilization. It's very evident that they now, in 2008, are very much back on track. I mean, the universities are humming with inventive energy. The Chinese are economically in the ascendancy. So maybe there was 400 years when not very much went on. Well, in Chinese historical terms, that's a hiccup. And I think why the Chinese hiccuped, well, academics can worry about that, but they're clearly back on track.
Simon Winchester is my guest. His new book is called The Man Who Loved China. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Bill in Dallas asks, how did Joseph Needham support himself while he was doing all his research? And did you, Simon, have to learn Chinese yourself in order to write about him?
Well, first of all, how did he support himself? He was paid for by the British government. He got leave from Cambridge University, where he was officially the university reader in biochemistry. And interestingly enough, that was when he died in 1995. He still was reader in biochemistry, even though everything he had been doing was involved either in history or Chinese. And the Department of History were very cross and said, you're not a historian. And the Department of Chinese said, you're not a sinologist. They were very cross. So with the petty minds that often inhabit academia, he was still regarded as a biochemist. But nonetheless, to go back to Bill's question, he was paid for by the British government while he was on his first trip to China. But he then went back to China many, many, many times. And I think in those trips, occasionally the Chinese government would pay. Occasionally Caius College, Cambridge, of which he was a fellow, would pay. But there was never any major financial problem. As to whether I learned Chinese, well, I followed in his footsteps on all of his great big journeys, and mercifully I had a less hard time than he did. I mean, his travel, I mean, not only was there a war going on, but he had all sorts of disasters which occupy a significant chunk of the book. But he spoke fluent Chinese, as I've mentioned. I speak what can best be described as halting Chinese. It sort of comes up to speed when I'm there, but it's pretty dreadful when I come back. So I'm useless as a linguist, in short.
Is there any reason to believe that he might have had some kind of intelligence-gathering function when he was being paid by the British government?
Well, it's tempting to think he might have done. Certainly, now that his diaries, in which he was immensely candid, never betrays a hint that he ever gave any information. I think the British government said, you know, you're a diplomat. You use your eyes and ears and tell us things, tell it to the ambassador, an ambassador who incidentally sent all his dispatches back to London from Chongqing, the capital, written in a quill pen, which I thought was rather charming, the last of the dying breed, I think. But officially a spy, I don't think so. He met some spies while he was there, and their story is fascinating, but I think Needham, he was too caught up in academic thinking, really, to worry himself with intelligence gathering.
And on the other side of the coin, was he later an apologist for Mao?
Well, yes, and I think that is something that has to be stated rather candidly. One of his obituaries, he died in 1995, March, said that he was brilliant in all respects and eccentric and wonderful, but politically he was a bit of a fathead. And he made, maybe we'll talk about it in the next section, a very bad series of decisions in the 1950s, but he wanted to keep cozy with Mao and Zhou Enlai, both of whom who he knew quite well, because he wanted all the time to have access to China to go back and do his researches. He never wanted that precious visa to be taken away. And a lot of his colleagues today said, you should have stood up and condemned, for instance, the Chinese, the Cultural Revolution. You should have stood up and you had influence after Tiananmen Square in 1989. But generally speaking, he kept somewhat silent, and people criticize him for that to this day.
So we will talk a bit more about those bad decisions that he made later on in later years. My guest this hour is Simon Winchester. His new book is about Joseph Needham. It's called The Man Who Loved China, the fantastic story of the eccentric scientist who unlocked the mysteries of the Middle Kingdom. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. If you'd like to send a question via email, the address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Simon Winchester. His new book is called The Man Who Loved China, the fantastic story of the eccentric scientist who unlocked the mysteries of the Middle Kingdom. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. So, Simon, during the Korean War, things are not going well for the Chinese, and there are suspicions that arise that perhaps the United States has been using biological agents, cholera, and I guess it was it yellow fever, cholera, and
all sorts of things, anthrax, even anthrax. Leprosy. I mean, someone said that they were dropping lepers by parachute into northern villages, a rather bizarre thought. But the Chinese approached Needham in Cambridge and asked him if he would head up an international commission made up of scientists to go and investigate these claims. And it was something of a poison chalice, I think, what it turned out to be. He did indeed go there and spent time. He was delighted to go back. And with these seven colleagues, they toured all over China investigating these allegations and wrote a report in which it was said incontrovertibly and above Needham's name that the Americans had indeed used biological weapons in the Korean War. And a tide of abuse rained down on Needham the moment he stepped off the plane back in London, because the British and particularly the American establishments were furious that he would say such a thing. He was just seen as a dupe of the communists, a tool, a mouthpiece. And he nearly, there was a move, unsuccessful, happily, to unseat him from his fellowship at his Cambridge college, to strip him of his fellowship at the Royal Society. And the Americans, this was, of course, course, at the beginning of the McCarthyite period in America, they banned him. They said, you can't come to America anymore for saying such dreadful things. And the ban was in place for 25 years. It wasn't until 1978 that his punishment in Washington's eyes for having accepted this position and written this report was lifted. And there was an unusual thing that happened when it was lifted, because in 1978, by that time, he was already enormously distinguished because a number of volumes of his book, Science and Civilization in China, had been published to astonishing rave reviews all around the world. He was master of his college at Cambridge, so a very distinguished fellow in British academic and establishment circles. Finally, the University of Chicago, in common with dozens of other universities around the world, offered him an honorary degree. And the State Department said, all right, Professor Needham, you can come in. So he was allowed in and gave three lectures in Chicago. And one of them, the second of his three lectures in the springtime of 1978, was on the early uses of Chinese gunpowder. And he drew or had slides prepared of early Chinese bombs. Well, one of the people in the audience, unknown to him at the time, was a chap called Ted Kaczynski, who 6 weeks later made the first bomb based on Needham's design, which exploded and injured a security guard and led to Ted Kaczynski being dubbed the Unabomber.
Had Needham in fact been right about the U.S. using biological agents in Korea?
Do you know, it's still an open question. There was a book which came out by two Canadian researchers 2 years ago which said, yes, he had been right. But then again, some documents surfaced from the KGB files. They first of all were translated into Japanese in Tokyo and more recently into English, which suggest that Needham was duped, and not by the Chinese, oddly enough, but by the Russians. It's all very complicated, but that the evidence of these infected voles and flies with tularemia in them and anthrax-infected rice cakes had all actually been planted in places that they expected these commission members and Needham to find them by Russian agents. So it's a very strange story. But the fact is that the Americans were producing biological weapons at the time at Fort Detrick in Maryland and had the capacity. And there are existing memorandum which showed that many generals in the U.S. Army at the time thought that there should be the employment of these weapons in Korea. Whether they actually were, it's still top secret. And when I attempted to use a Freedom of Information Act suit to persuade the CIA to release their files, I was completely stonewalled. So it's still an open question. Some people think, yes, we know that he was duped, but there's still some suggestion that the Americans were guilty as charged.
So Dorothy Needham and Joseph Needham remained married for decades. Finally, when she was 92 and he was 87, she died.
She died in 1987. And romantically, I think it's a rather wonderful aspect of this story, he then married Gui Zhen, who had been waiting in the wings patiently for 51 years. And she lived for just 800 days, I think. She was not well, and the marriage was a very cheerful occasion, and Joseph raised a toast to her and said, better late than never. And then she died shortly thereafter, and he then, rather incautiously, but despite the fact that he was now 90, wrote three letters of proposal, not at the same time, but in succession, to three other women he knew, and they all sensibly said, well, thanks, Joseph. It's awfully sweet of you, but we think we won't marry you. And he then died. He was awarded the Companionship of Honor by the Queen, which is the greatest civil honor that Her Majesty can give, in, I think, 92. And then he died in March 1995.
He was 94 years old, still writing, still working. Did he consider his work fundamentally unfinished?
He wrestled with this in about the mid-1980s. He realized he couldn't finish it in his lifetime, but he, with the help of Americans, with the help of the Mellon Foundation, an institute was set up in Cambridge, which exists today, the Needham Research Institute, where Dorothy, Joseph, and Gui Zhen, their ashes commingled, are all buried under a tree in the grounds. And he knew that this institute, where this enormous library, this prodigious library he established, is at the core of it, the research goes on. So by the time he died in 95, 17 of the volumes of the book had been produced. Since his death, there have been a further 7, including a monster book on Chinese ceramics, which has, I think, 400 pages on clay alone. I mean, the depth of these books is quite amazing. And there are another 4 planned. So in another 3 or 4 years, the entire series, Science and Civilization in China by Joseph Needham, which is available. One can buy it today. It's extremely expensive. His monument will have been completed. But he knew he couldn't finish it himself. China's too big for one man, he said.
So certainly he was well-known and appreciated in China, and his work helped to change the way the West looked at China. Did it actually have any impact on the way Chinese people saw themselves, or is that really assuming too much about this Westerner who came in and sort of evaluated the culture from outside?
Well, it is interesting that whereas you and I mean, I didn't know, as I said at the beginning of our chat, I didn't know anything about Needham back in the 1990s, and I think most people listening to this have probably never heard of this man. I hope the book will change that. But in China, his name, Li Yusi, is known by every educated Chinese person. If you go to any school, no matter whether it's in Xi'an in the north or Guangzhou in the south or Dalian in the northeast or Dunhuang in the west, you ask a school child, do you know who Li Yusi is? They'll say, oh yes, I'm the most famous Englishman ever to have lived in China. He gave us a view of ourselves, which we didn't really have. There was a sort of, yes, a self-confidence about the Chinese that had always existed, a realization that their society was immensely ancient and that they had achieved all sorts of things. But Needham, they loved the fact that a Westerner uncovered the vast history of Chinese science and presented it to them, so they were flattered and their confidence was very much boosted by him, yes.
Do you think that Joseph Needham would recognize China as it is today? A lot has happened in the 12 years since he's died.
Well, he and Dorothy and then he later and Gui Zhen would come back in their 70s and 80s. I mean, still raising money. This goes back to Bill's question for the project. Even in his, I think, 86, someone in Hong Kong said, why is Cambridge sending this poor old man out to here to raise money? He should be comfortably back in his suite in Cambridge, a suite which incidentally is occupied today by Stephen Hawking, room K1 in the court at Caius College. But would he recognize it? Well, he didn't recognize it when he went back in the late 80s. He couldn't find the apartment where he lived, and I think that would have saddened him. But the astonishing advance of China, turning it admittedly physically unrecognizable to him, was something I was certain that he always was sure would come to fruition. He would have approved, I know. I saw outside the Chinese Space Center in a place called Jiuquan in far western China, a place where, curiously enough, rhubarb is supposed to have originated. Now it's where all Chinese satellites are sent up from. And there is a notice board which says in large letters, without haste, without fear, we shall conquer the world. I think Needham, if he had seen that, would have said, absolutely, right on, and knew that would happen one day.
One thing that's very interesting is that now it would seem the Chinese are in a position to dictate their own story to the rest of the world instead of relying on someone else to sort of come in and untangle it for them.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, everything has changed intellectually as well as socially and economically for the Chinese, and there may well be a reevaluation of the Needham question by the Chinese, but certainly there are departments of the history of science in all the great universities in China today, but they're tending to be sort of overlooked in the great headlong rush of to modernism and prosperity. And the China that I go to now, and I go several times a year, is just a furious maelstrom of economic activity, and one wonders whether the intellectual activity is slightly being pushed to the sidelines. By economic activity, yes. I mean, it's just extraordinary. You go to Shanghai today, and yes, the scientific achievement is apace at the various institutes at the universities. But whether matters like history are seen as so important at the moment, I'm not certain, as indeed studies of their language and their culture. I think everything at the moment is ever so slightly on hold. Let's embrace technology, let's embrace and move, get everyone modernized and buy cars and cell phones for everyone and have super highways. It's such an extraordinary country today.
Yeah, what do you make of that question? And I guess it speaks to what you were talking about right now, that currently a lot of the Chinese economy is still not innovating new technologies. It's taking things that have been invented elsewhere and learning to manufacture them in a pristine way. Do you think that's about to change?
I do, very much so. And that goes back to what I was just saying about the universities that I've been to and all over China. I mean, it's fairly obvious that things like this are going on in the Beida, the big university in Beijing, and the university in Shanghai. But if you go up the river, if you go to Nanjing, when I say the river, I mean the Yangtze, if you go to Nanjing and then to Wuhan and then to Chongqing and Changsha, you go to the universities there. And my wife and I were at Changsha University, one of the most ancient universities in the world, incidentally. And you go to the departments of science now, and there's all sorts of absolute cutting-edge, bleeding-edge research going on. Obviously, the long-term effects of the intellectual desuetude during the Cultural Revolution are still being felt, but they're back on track, and I have no doubt that real innovation is going to start trickling into the economy, into the manufacturing sector before long. So, right, it's not happening too much now. It's a bit like Japan, you just improve on things, but soon they'll have their own stuff, I've no doubt at all.
So the whole book really is delightful. It's fun to read. It's entertaining. But at the end, you include this appendix of things that were invented in China, which is fascinating. Can you talk about maybe one or two of the things that took you most by surprise?
Well, I think I was, without being sort of unnecessarily prurient, I was amused that the toilet paper was invented by the Chinese, and that whereas the rest of us were all using gravel or whatever, they had perfumed paper for the imperial and indeed for the popular bottoms a long, long time ago. But almost in every field there were things which you take for granted. I think the stirrup is perhaps the most important, but the compass hugely important, and yet, of course, put not to good use, because the Chinese were very keen navigators and had a compass to allow them to navigate until this admiral, Islamic Chinese eunuch called Zheng He, took an expedition using this compass, which took him as far as Mogadishu and perhaps even farther than that. He came back with a giraffe, which so terrified the emperor, he said, well, you mustn't go traveling again, and banned travel for years. So they might have invented the compass, but they didn't use it very much.
That might be the subject of your next book, I'm not sure. Simon Winchester's book right now is called The Man Who Loved China. Simon, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.